Vigor felt the icy wind of the night sweep over him, and he discovered that he was wet with sweat. Somehow, something had happened, and now things were out of his hands. He was nervously poised, waiting for what the new flow of events would bring. The smoke drifted past him toward the open door. The room was clearing. The smoke thinned to a gray pall. He heard the man grunting and saw him bend over, digging at the ashes in the bin. He wanted to go to him and ask for the shovel. He wanted to say that he could take care of it now, but he did not move. He felt that he had let things slip through his hands to such an extent that he could not get at them again. Then he heard the draft. This time, a long, low sucking of air that grew gradually to a drone, then a roar. The air passage was clear.
"There was a hell of a lot of ashes in there, boy," the man gasped. "You shouldn't let it get that way."
"Yes, sir," Vigor whispered. The draft roared loud now. The air passage was completely clear.
"Shut that door, boy. It's cold in here," one of the men called.
He wanted to go to the door and keep right on out of it and shut it behind him. But he did not move. One of the men closed it, and Vigor felt the cold air fall away from his wet body. He looked round. The men were still standing about the table, red-eyed, sipping coffee.
"What's the matter, boy?" one of them asked.
"Nothing," Vigor said. The man with the shovel stood in front of the furnace and looked down into the ashes strewn over the floor.
"What's he doing?" Vigor wondered.
He saw the man stoop and poke the shovel into the ashes.
"What's he looking at?"
Bigger's muscles twitched. He wanted to run to the man's side and see what it was he was looking at. He had in his mind an image of Mary's head lying there, bloody and unburnt, before the man's eyes. Suddenly, the man straightened, only to stoop again, as though unable to decide if the evidence of his eyes was true. Bigger edged forward, his lungs not taking in or letting out air. He himself was a huge furnace now, through which no air could go, and the fear that surged into his stomach, filling him, choking him, was like the fumes of smoke that had belched from the ash bin.
"Say,"
the man called. His voice sounded tentative, dubious.
"What?"
one man at the table answered.
"Come here. Look."
The man's voice was low, excited, tense. But what it lacked in volume was more than made up for in the breathless manner in which he spoke. The words had rolled without effort from his lips. The men set their cups down and ran to the pile of ashes. Bigger, doubtful and uncertain, paused as the men ran past him.
"What is it? What's the matter?"
Bigger tiptoed and looked over their shoulders. He did not know how he got strength enough to go and look. He just found himself walking and then found himself standing and peering over the men's shoulders. He saw a pile of scattered ashes. Nothing else. But there must be something. Or why would the men be looking?
"What is it?"
"See? This."
"What?"
"Look. It's..."
The man's voice trailed off, and he stooped again and poked the shovel deeper. Bigger saw come into full view on the surface of the ashes several small pieces of white bone. Instantly, his whole body was wrapped in a sheet of fear.
"It's bone."
"Aw," one of the men said. "That's just some garbage they're burning."
"No, wait. Let's see that."
"Tormund, come here. You studied medicine once."
The man called Tormund reached out his foot and kicked an oblong bone from the ashes. It slid a few inches over the concrete floor.
My God, it's from a body. And look, here's something.
One of them stooped and picked up a bit of round metal and held it close to his eyes.
It's an earring.
There was silence. Bigger stared without a thought or an image in his mind. There was just the old feeling. The feeling that he had had all his life. He was black and had done wrong. White men were looking at something with which they would soon accuse him. It was the old feeling, hard and constant again now, of wanting to grab something and clutch it in his hands and swing it into someone's face. He knew. They were looking at the bones of Mary's body. Without its making a clear picture in his mind, he understood how it had happened. Some of the bones had not burnt and had fallen into the lower bin when he had worked the handle to sift the ashes. The white man had poked in the shovel to clear the air passage and had raked them out. And now, there they lay, tiny, oblong pieces of white bone, cushioned in gray ashes. He could not stay here now. At any moment, they would begin to suspect him. They would hold him. They would not let him go, even if they were not certain whether he had done it or not. And Jan was still in jail, swearing that he had an alibi. They would know that Mary was dead. They had stumbled upon the white bones of her body. They would be looking for the murderer. The men were silent, bent over, poking into the pile of gray ashes. Bigger saw the hatchet blade come into view.
God.
The whole world was tumbling down. Quickly, Bigger's eyes looked at their bent backs. They were not watching him. The red glare of the fire lit their faces, and the draft of the furnace drummed. Yes, he would go. Now. He tiptoed to the rear of the furnace and stopped, listening. The men were whispering in tense tones of horror.
It's the girl. Good God! Who do you suppose did it?
Bigger tiptoed up the steps, one at a time, hoping that the roar of the furnace and the men's voices and the scraping of the shovel would drown out the creaking sounds his feet made. He reached the top of the steps and breathed deeply, his lungs aching from holding themselves full of air so long. He stole to the door of his room and opened it, and went in and pulled down the light. He turned to the window and put his hands under the upper ledge and lifted. He felt a cold rush of air laden with snow. He heard muffled shouts downstairs, and the inside of his stomach glowed white hot. He ran to the door and locked it, and then turned out the light. He groped to the window and climbed into it, feeling again the chilling blast of snowy wind. With his feet upon the bottom ledge, his legs bent under him, his sweaty body shaken by wind, he looked into the snow and tried to see the ground below, but he could not. Then he leaped, headlong, sensing his body twisting in the icy air as he hurtled. His eyes were shut, and his hands were clenched as his body turned, sailing through the snow. He was in the air a moment, then he hit. It seemed at first that he hit softly, but the shock of it went through him, up his back to his head, and he lay buried in a cold pile of snow, dazed. Snow was in his mouth, eyes, ears. Snow was seeping down his back. His hands were wet and cold. Then he felt all of the muscles of his body contract violently, caught in a spasm of reflex action, and at the same time he felt his groin laved with warm water. It was his urine. He had not been able to control the muscles of his hot body against the chilled assault of the wet snow all over his skin. He lifted his head, blinking his eyes, and looked above him. He sneezed. He was himself now. He struggled against the snow, pushing it away from him. He got to his feet one at a time and pulled himself out. He walked, then tried to run, but he felt too weak. He went down Drexel Boulevard, not knowing just where he was heading, but knowing that he had to get out of this white neighborhood. He avoided the car line, turned down dark streets, walking more rapidly now, his eyes before him, but turning, now and then, to look behind. Yes. He would have to tell Bessie not to go to that house. It was all over. He had to save himself. But it was familiar, this running away. All his life he had been knowing that sooner or later, something like this would come to him. And now, here it was. He had always felt outside of this white world, and now it was true. It made things simple. He felt in his shirt. Yes, the gun was still there. He might have to use it. He would shoot before he would let them take him. It meant death either way, and he would die shooting every slug he had. He came to Cottage Grove Avenue and walked southward. He could not make any plans until he got to Bessie's and got the money. He tried to shut out of his mind the fear of being caught. He lowered his head against the driving snow and tramped through the icy streets with clenched fists. Although his hands were almost frozen, he did not want to put them in his pockets, for that would have made him feel that he would not have been ready to defend himself were the police to accost him suddenly. He went on past street lamps covered with thick coatings of snow, gleaming like huge frosted moons above his head. His face ached from the sub-zero cold, and the wind cut into his wet body like a long, sharp knife, going to the heart of him with pain. He was in sight of 47th Street now. He saw, through a gauze-like curtain of snow, a boy standing under an awning selling papers. He pulled his cap visor lower and slipped into a doorway to wait for a car. Back of the newsboy was a stack of papers piled high upon a newsstand. He wanted to see the tall black headline, but the driving snow would not let him. The papers ought to be full of him now. It did not seem strange that they should be. For all his life, he had felt that things had been happening to him that should have gone into them, but only after he had acted upon feelings which he had had for years would the papers carry the story, his story. He felt that they had not wanted to print it as long as it had remained buried and burning in his own heart. But now that he had thrown it out, thrown it at those who made him live as they wanted, the papers were printing it. He fished 3 cents out of his pocket. He went over to the boy with averted face. Tribune. He took the paper into a doorway. His eyes swept the streets above the top of it. Then he read in tall black type. Millionaire heiress kidnapped. Abductors demand $10,000 in ransom note. Dalton family ask release of communist suspect. Yes. They had it now. Soon they would have the story of her death. Of the reporters finding her bones in the furnace. Of her head being cut off. Of his running away during the excitement. He looked up, hearing the approach of a car. When it heaved into sight, he saw that it was almost empty of passengers. Good. He ran into the street and reached the steps just as the last man got on. He paid his fare, watching to see if the conductor was noticing him, then went through the car, watching to see if any face was turned to him. He stood on the front platform, back of the motorman. If anything happened, he could get off quickly here. The car started, and he opened the paper again, reading. A servant's discovery early yesterday evening of a crudely penciled ransom note demanding $10,000 for the return of Mary Dalton, missing Chicago heiress, and the Dalton family's sudden demand for the release of Jan Erlone, communist leader, held in connection with the girl's disappearance, were the startling developments in a case which is baffling local and state police. The note bearing the signature of Red and the famed hammer and sickle emblem of the Communist Party was found sticking under the door by Peggy O'Flaherty, a cook and housekeeper in the Henry Dalton residence in Hyde Park. Bigger read a long stretch of type in which was described the questioning of a Negro chauffeur, the half-packed trunk, the communist pamphlets, drunken sexual orgies, the frantic parents, and the radical's contradictory story. Bigger's eyes skimmed the words, clandestine meetings offered opportunities for abduction, police asked not to interfere in case, anxious family trying to contact kidnappers, and it was conjectured that perhaps the family had information to the effect that Erlone knew of the whereabouts of Miss Dalton, and certain police officials assigned that as the motive behind the family's request for the radical's release, reiterating that police had framed him as part of a drive to oust communists from Chicago. Erlone demanded that the charges upon which he had been originally held be made public. Failing to obtain a satisfactory answer, he refused to leave jail, whereupon police again remanded him to his cell upon a charge of disorderly conduct. Bigger lifted his eyes and looked about. No one was watching him. His hand was shaking with excitement. The car moved lumberingly through the snow, and he saw that he was near 50th Street. He stepped to the door and said, "Out." The car stopped, and he swung off into the driving snow. He was almost in front of Bessie's now. He looked up to her window. It was dark. The thought that she might not be in her room, but out drinking with friends, made him angry. He went into the vestibule. A dim light glowed, and his body was thankful for the meager warmth. He could finish reading the paper now. He unfolded it. Then, for the first time, he saw his picture. It was down in the lower left-hand corner of page 2. Above it he read, "Reds tried to snare him." It was a small picture, and his name was under it. He looked solemn and black, and his eyes gazed straight, and the white cat sat perched upon his right shoulder, its big round black eyes twin pools of secret guilt. And oh, here was a picture of Mr. and Mrs. Dalton standing upon the basement steps. That the image of Mr. and Mrs. Dalton, which he had seen but 2 hours ago, should be seen again so soon, made him feel that this whole vague white world which could do things this quickly was more than a match for him, that soon it would track him down and have it out with him. The white-haired old man and the white-haired old woman standing on the steps with their arms stretched forth pleadingly were a powerful symbol of helpless suffering and would stir up a lot of hate against him when it was found out that a Negro had killed Mary. Bigger's lips tightened. There was no chance of his getting that money now. They had found Mary, and would stop at nothing to get the one who had killed her. There would be 1,000 white policemen on the South Side searching for him, or any black man who looked like him. He pressed the bell and waited for the buzzer to ring. Was she there? Again he pressed the bell, holding his finger hard upon it until the door buzzed. He bounded up the steps, sucking his breath in sharply at each lift of his knees. When he reached the second landing, he was breathing so hard that he stopped, closed his eyes, and let his chest heave itself to stillness. He glanced up and saw Bessie staring sleepily at him through the half-open door. He went in and stood for a moment in the darkness.
"Turn on the light," he said.
"Bigger, what's happened?"
"Turn on the light."
She said nothing and did not move. He groped forward, sweeping the air with his open palm for the cord. He found it and jerked on the light. Then he whirled and looked about him, expecting to see someone lurking in the corners of the room.
"What's happened?"
She came forward and touched his clothes.
"You're wet."
"It's all off," he said.
"I don't have to do it?"
she asked eagerly. "Yes." She was thinking only of herself now. He was alone.
"Bigger, tell me what happened."
"They know all about it. They'll be after me soon."
Her eyes were too filled with fear to cry. He walked about aimlessly, and his shoes left rings of dirty water on the wooden floor.
Tell me, Biggle, please.
She was wanting the word that would free her of this nightmare.